What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. I am your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Mike Croissant. Mike Croissant is a retired CIA officer, historian, and author. Prior to his retirement from the CIA in 2021, after a nearly 22-year career, Mike served as a political analyst in the Directorate of Analysis and as a targeting officer in the Directorate of Operations. He served multiple tours of duty in the Middle East and South Asia, and his work in counterterrorism focused on every major foreign terrorist enterprise of the past two decades. This would include Al-Qaeda, ISIS, the Taliban, and all of their affiliates. In recognition of his efforts, Mike was awarded the CIA's Career Commendation Medal upon retirement. He is also a published author of books and articles on security issues in the former Soviet Union and a nonfiction book about World War II, which is forthcoming, which we do discuss. It was such a pleasure speaking with him and hearing his oral history with regards to where he was during 9/11 and the Osama bin Laden raid. It was very informative, and I hope you enjoy. And now I give you Mike Croissant. Okay. I'm here with Mike Croissant. Mike, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. There's so much I want to talk with you about, Mike. I want to discuss, obviously, your time with the CIA and your book, Bombing Hitler's Hometown. But before we get into all that, please tell our listeners kind of who you are and what you do.
Sure. Thank you for having me on the show. I really enjoy it. I was born in Marcellus, Illinois, a very small town in the center of the state, 90 minutes from Chicago, graduating high school class of 44. Just, you know, one of those towns where everybody knows everybody else and just a great place to grow up in the 70s and 80s. I was thankful to have the opportunity to go to college. I went to the University of Illinois for 4 years, got a degree in history and political science, and then went off and got a couple of master's degrees in strategic studies and area studies. I had always been interested in current events growing up. And I tell sort of a funny story. My mom says that I would never go to bed until I had seen the news because I was so into the current events. And one of my earliest memories is hearing on TV a news segment about Palestinian guerrillas. And, you know, this was before Star Wars. I'm a big Star Wars fan. This was before Star Wars. And before Star Wars, I had like the Godzilla movies, like the old ones, the guys in the plastic suits. And
sure.
I had the original Planet of the Apes movies. So when I heard Palestinian guerrillas, I was thinking, guerrillas? Wait a minute, guerrillas? I didn't know, of course. I was like six or seven, what the difference was between guerrillas in the military sense or gorillas in the terms of Planet of the Apes. So, yeah, I figured it out, but it's just kind of a funny way my little mind worked back then. But anyway, I went to college, went to graduate school, very interested in current events, and lots of stuff was happening back then. This was the, you know, early 90s, the Soviet Union broke up, and all of these new states sort of suddenly emerged on the scene. And there was, you know, these little ethnic conflicts breaking out all over the place. And it was really interesting to me. So I went to Indiana University, got one of my two masters from there. And there I studied Uzbek, the Uzbek language, spoken in Uzbekistan and parts of Afghanistan. And I also studied Azerbaijani, spoken in Azerbaijan. So late in my time at Indiana, the CIA came recruiting very fortuitously for me, and I was able to land an interview. And by then, I had published a book, and I had published a couple of scholarly articles and studied these two languages, and it was enough to intrigue them, apparently. So they shortly thereafter offered me a conditional offer of employment, and after polygraph test and, you know, the whole background check and security check and all that, several months later, I went to work. So it was December 1999 when I reported for duty. I was initially a political analyst in the Office of Russian and European Analysis. And they put me right to work on to use some of the skills that I had, skills and languages I had learned.
Excellent. Excellent. Thanks, Mike. So, yeah, so one of the questions I kind of had is, as you were coming up with the CIA, what is the actual training like? You know, we hear the term CIA training and all kinds of images are conjured up to someone like myself, right? So what is that training like?
You know, it's changed a lot over time. When I first started to work, I learned everything on the job. Like, I think my second or third day, literally second or third day, maybe toward the end of my first week on duty, I was writing things for the Vice President of the United States, who was just crazy. Like, they're like, wow. Here you go. This is your issue. This is basically how we write this piece. And I said, okay. You know, and early the next year, I think the agency began sort of a holistic training program for analysts, in which, you know, they basically purge everything you know about how to write as you come up through college. You know, the scholarly way of writing is to gradually get to your main point. And in the CIA, it's the exact opposite. You know, you've put the main point first, so the policymaker will know immediately, you know, within the first sentence or two, what the whole piece is going to be about. The agency instituted that after I had already been on the job. So I was essentially a self-trained analyst. I did pick up some individual courses as I went along. But to answer your question more broadly, you know, the agency has so many different professions, if you will, so many types of jobs. And we do all kinds of things. And for each one, there is a lot of training. I did a lot of cool stuff in addition to just the analytical training. Like, before going abroad, you can receive pistol and sometimes rifle training, receive training on defensive driving, which is a blast, and just all kinds of stuff. And a lot of times I felt like I had to pinch myself and see if I was really being paid to do these really fun training classes. Like, you know, you crash cars and you get led into ambushes and you have to get out of them, all kinds of fun stuff. It was a blast and very practical, because I definitely used some of that. I mean, I didn't go and crash cars, but what I'm saying is you learn how to have street smarts and how to drive in a way that protect you. And I definitely use those out in the field.
Very, very cool. Is there a, by the way, if there's something that's classified that you can't talk about, just tell me and I'll move on.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm just kind of curious, Mike, you mentioned the ambush training. Is there an example maybe you can give on what that looks like? I think I have an idea in my head.
Well, there's scenario-based training as part of these longer courses. And, you know, you'll be driving along and with a group of other students and maybe an instructor. And all of a sudden, you know, hell breaks loose and you got simulated RPGs flying over the hood, over the roof of the car, explosions going off, some munitions being lit up on the vehicle, and you just have to react. You know, the instructor may act like he's been hit and goes down, so the car is inoperable and you have to, you know, bail out in a safe way and just basically get off the ambush point and get to safety. You may do that with weapons, you may do it, you know, just nothing but your legs to get you off. But there's lots of different iterations of the course is what I'm saying. But it's a lot of fun, and it can be nerve wracking, and definitely wakes you up when it all suddenly, even though you know it's not real, it sure feels like it there in the moment.
He keeps you on your toes in any case.
Yeah.
No, thank you, Mike. My next question, well, I suppose takes on a similar form to my last question. So if you already answered it, I'll just move on. But as far as like what your day-to-day was, a lot of people think of, you know, our famous agents, right? All the JBs, Bond, Bourne, Bauer, etc. So what was the day-to-day like at the CIA?
Well, the day-to-day, of course, depends on
what day it is.
What your professional, you know, what your duties are. For me, you know, the first roughly half of my career, I was a political analyst, which means we kept up with current events and we tried to project for the policymaker, you know, what they need to be thinking about. Are there any trends at work in whatever region that they need to be concerned about or pay attention to? You know, is there an election coming up that could be cause for them needing to pay attention to it? you know, anything you could think of that an American president or secretary might, or lower levels may need to think about, we would have to try to prepare them for that. It's primarily done with writing, like I discussed earlier. You know, you write various different kinds of products, but most of them are very short. You know, for the president of the United States, you would get a page, if you're lucky, two pages, a longer, what you might think of as the research paper in college for us would be, you know, five pages, rare instances more than that. So you basically learn how you have to be a master of the English language. You have to write in a very stripped down way to convey the very, what's often very nuanced and complicated things in a very condensed form. And the reason for that is the American policymaker just has limited time and limited mental space. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way. They have so much on their mind at any given moment that you need to communicate in the most concise way possible to get them up to speed and provide warning or opportunity analysis or whatever it may be.
Fascinating. So as you might imagine, Mike, with a show like Eyewitness History, I sort of view my great responsibility to the listener is to put them there with you, right? I'm, of course, mindful of the fact, because you and I have communicated by email, that a great deal of your stories will be classified and thus you won't be able to discuss, which is totally fine, obviously. However, one story that I suspect a mutual audience would be interested in is hearing what the CIA offices were like on 9/11. I'd love for you to go into that. And also, I'd love to know where you were when you first heard that the plane hit.
Sure. If I could go back, I realized I didn't fully answer the last question.
Sure.
As I said, I was a political analyst roughly the first half of my career. So the day-to-day job doesn't change a whole lot. You know, things come up. You may have to go do a briefing in person to a policymaker. You have a lot of meetings. You meet with other intelligence agencies, you meet with FBI, other players in the, you know, process. Later in my career, I did almost exclusively counterterrorism, and that's a whole different, you know, ballpark. That became more focused on operations, meaning, you know, in some cases, disrupting attack plans, disrupting attack networks, financial networks. A lot more action oriented, which is what I was looking for. I did that both domestically per se. I mean, I was based in America doing that, and I also did it abroad, which is where you can kind of see everything come together. So it was very rewarding, and it's also very sobering because, you know, if you make a mistake, you know, stuff can really go sideways. And I went up against every major terrorist organization of the last 20 years, really, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and the Taliban, as well as most of their affiliates. So I saw a lot. I did a lot. It was very rewarding, and I'm very, very glad I did it. So 9/11, to me, it started out differently than for most people at CIA, because on September 9th, 2001, Ahmad Shah Massoud, the leader of the Northern Alliance, which was the main resistance to the Taliban in Afghanistan, he was assassinated in Afghanistan by, I believe, two Al-Qaeda operatives who were posing as journalists. So as a political analyst for one of the countries that borders Afghanistan, we all knew when we got there Monday morning, September 10th, when we learned this news, that something was happening that would impact the countries that we were responsible for. So I remember September 10th, learning about his unfortunate assassination and just wondering, talking with my colleagues about what it would mean. Because, you know, if back then the Taliban did not yet have total control of Afghanistan. And with the removal of this great leader, this resistance leader, what would it mean if the Taliban were to take full control of the country? So we were working through all these things. So September 10th turns to September 11th. Most, not all, but most teams, especially analytical teams, have a morning meeting just to discuss the news, what's going on, what are you doing today? What are you writing? Do you have any meetings? That kind of stuff. So For us, I believe the meeting was right around the 8:30 time frame in the morning. And because of Massoud's assassination, because of things going on, and that meeting went pretty long. Now, we were in, at CIA headquarters, there's two buildings. There's the original headquarters building, which was built in the 1950s, and the new headquarters building, which was born in the 1980s. My office was in the original headquarters building, and it looked right out over the parking lot toward the Potomac River. And I'll return to this later, but it was also the flight path for many of the aircraft that land at Reagan National Airport. So that morning, we were in the morning meeting, just discussing what was going on. Had no clue that anything was going on. The meeting went pretty long, and I don't know when we exactly got out, but we left the conference room and returned to our office. And it was a long rectangular office that we shared with another group. And I could hear down at the other side of the office a television on pretty loudly. And that was not normal because, you know, you try to be quiet and respectful to everyone else around, not have the TV or radio on or whatnot. TV was on and I could see people milling around. So I knew, okay, that's not normal. So I walked down there, and that's when I saw. And by this point, both towers had been hit. So it was obvious that we were under attack. You know, a lot of people talk about one tower is hit, they don't know what's going on, then the second one is hit, and it seems pretty clear. But for me, the story starts with, you know, okay, we're under attack. So obvious emotions are anger, disbelief, and, you know, just what is going on. I returned to my desk, and the technology back then was fairly rudimentary, but I could stream live news on my computer. So I started streaming, and I called my mother in Florida, make sure she was watching. I called my wife in Virginia, who was pregnant with our first child. I told her to turn the TV on. And I remember just sitting there watching the news and just trying to wrap my head around it. Pretty shortly thereafter, the reports come out that the Pentagon has been hit. And the Pentagon is just down the George Washington Parkway from the CIA, just a number of miles. And that, to me, changed my calculus. I had a friend there, good friend. The wing of the plane went into the office right below him and knocked him, as I understand it, knocked him into the ceiling and set much of the room on fire. But he was able to get out. And anyway, that's an aside. Pentagon's been hit. That changes my calculus. I know that this isn't just, you know, limited to New York City. So I called my mother again. And I told her that I was going to be leaving the building. And I called my wife and told her the same. And at that point, I closed down my computer and evacuated. And I remember walking out of the building, as I described it, it sort of faces the flight path where a lot of the planes that come into Washington National Airport land. They pass over, you know, about every minute or less, at probably 5,000 feet or less. So it's an obvious thing. You know, they're right there and you hear them pretty loudly. So I walk out of there and the sky is this perfect deep blue. There are no jets in the sky and you can hear a pin drop. It was just, I think, when we're exposed to things like, you know, an airport near where you live, or a railway that passes by where you live, you tend to just sort of filter it out after a while and you don't notice it anymore. But I walked out of that building and it was like the world had just stopped turning. It was, everything was completely still. So I walked a little ways to my car and evacuated the facility. I lived pretty far out, about 25 miles out to the west is where I lived, near Dulles Airport, actually. And I'll return to that later. But I just started to drive home. And this was before you could stream anything on your cell phone. So all I had was radio, tuned in the radio, the local station, news station. And I'm driving. I'm trying to call my wife and my mother again to tell them that I made it out. But cell phone circuits were all busy. So I'm driving and in the time it took to drive home, both towers fell. And as I said, I couldn't stream it. I'm just listening to the radio. So I'm trying to picture in my head, the World Trade Centers have fallen. I mean, what does that even look like? And I'm picturing, you know, them falling to the side and taking out all the buildings around them. And I didn't picture, you know, the pancaking down that they did. So I remember driving, and I'm scared to death. I'm angry. I'm confused. And I'm just wondering, did we just lose 20,000 people? Because, you know, back then, 10 or 12,000 people worked in each one of those towers. And no one was aware until days or weeks after how effective the fire department and police evacuation effort at the site had been. So I'm thinking, here I am, I'm a CIA officer, and as many as 20,000 people just died on my watch. You know, I wasn't a counterterrorism officer at that time, and I had nothing to do with it in terms of, you know, providing warning about Al-Qaeda or anything like that. But I did, and I do still carry some feelings of guilt because my father and my uncle were both in World War II, so I grew up knowing well what Pearl Harbor, what it was like to hear about Pearl Harbor and to have that sneak attack happen. And it was just a kick in the gut. And I don't care if I had something to do with the counterterrorism piece then or had nothing to do with it. I think most of the people in the building that day probably feel the way I do in that. And we carry some guilt. Maybe that's fair, maybe it's not. But anyway, I'm driving home thinking that, you know, thousands of people have died. And this fact is sometimes not spoken about. There were reports of a car bomb at the State Department. Those later turned out to be false, but it just felt like the world was ending. You know, it felt like Armageddon, and it's 9/11 in retrospect is treated as this, you know, limited horrific event. But, you know, living it and responding to it, we didn't know what was going to happen next. You know, would there be more targets struck? So it was just like the world was ending. So I got home finally, and you know, my wife was a couple of months pregnant, so it was very emotional to see her and to hug her. And we spent the day watching the news, and that's when I saw the replays of the towers falling. And it's indescribable, really. And again, like I said, we were very close to Dulles Airport. So again, the planes would literally landing almost right over the top of our apartment every day, about every 30 seconds, you know, and not at 5,000 feet. I'm talking like 2,000 or 1,000. So it was, you know, loud. And again, just looking out the patio, the sky was completely empty. And it felt like that day, just the weather, it felt like you were inside a postcard. It was just a perfect day in terms of weather and and very little wind. It was a beautiful fall day, and yet, you know, people were dying.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Severe clear was a phrase that we became very used to for the first time on September 11th to describe the sky conditions. Sorry, I didn't mean to jump in there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So spent the day and well into the night just trying to come to grips. I couldn't get through to my friend in the Pentagon, who was worried that he was dead. And I think mid-afternoon, maybe early evening, is when I believe a senator leaked that we had had an intercept. We, the U.S. government, had had an intercept of Al-Qaeda claiming responsibility, which is something I and many suspected anyway, but that sort of nailed it. So I knew that my world professionally had changed, and went to bed thinking, okay, my generation's Pearl Harbor has happened. It happened on my watch, but thank the Lord I get to be in a position to do something about it. So I got up the next day. Because I live so far out, I typically got there before the sun came up. I remember making the walk from the parking lot in the dark and coming in the entrance. I can still see it in my mind's eye, walking in with just a handful of other people. I was physically ready for what came next, but spiritually and emotionally, I was absolutely crushed. It was just this feeling of, and you know, what I resent the most, besides the death and the economic damage, what I resent is the feeling of complete helplessness. Like that day, just knowing there was not a thing that I could do to do anything at all about what was happening. So I carried that with me as I walked into the building, this soul-crushing anger and fear and sadness. And then that was tempered by, okay, now I can do something, and it's on. So I just got to work, lots of meetings, lots of, you know, where do we go from here? Lots of sadness, lots of anger. Now our countries, as I said, the countries that I did analysis for were on September 10th, sort of back strategic backwaters for the United States. And now, literally 2 days later, they're the frontline states. So the world had literally changed professionally overnight. And now we're on a war footing. And the question becomes, how does this impact the countries that we do analysis for? And what role will they play in what we all know is going to happen next? So that's what we did. We just started to think, you know, what could the American policymaker ask of these countries? What could they ask of them to do for us to help us out? What could this sudden victory for jihadists mean for the jihadist groups that were working to overthrow these countries? You know, there was the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan in particular that I was following a lot. Just all kinds of different questions, strategically and tactically, that we had to deal with. So over the course of the days and weeks that followed, it was just getting ready. You know, nobody told us the details of the plan to respond, but we all knew that something was going to be happening. So we got to work. We eventually the United States established military bases in a couple of the countries and had a little bit to do with that, not too much, but it was just, you know, get ready and try to prepare the policymaker for anything that might happen going forward. Let's see, do you have anything you want me to add to that? Or?
No, that was perfect.
So it's later in September, I think of the 27th, my manager, whose second day on the job was September 11th, calls me into his office and said, the vice president is coming and I need you to go with me to brief him. So gulp. You know, I was less than 2 years on the job at this point. I didn't have a suit or nice shoes. The CIA has a business casual policy, which I definitely milked over the course of my career. So I was not ready in any way for this briefing of the vice president. So I called my wife and we met halfway. She gave me a suit, gave me shoes, came back and go up to the seventh floor of the original headquarters building, which is where the director's office is. And we're admitted to the director's conference room. And there is the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, the Deputy Director of Central Intelligence, the Director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, Vice President Dick Cheney, and a couple of others. And we sit across this long table across from them and give a little bit of a briefing and then just start fielding questions. And believe it or not, true story, our Jawbreaker team, that was the code name for the CIA team that went into Afghanistan, had landed in Afghanistan the day before, and I didn't know about it. Back then, the agency was very compartmented on things like this. So I literally briefed the vice president about, you know, the things we talked about without even knowing that we had boots on the ground. It's crazy. And that was changed later as they sort of integrated. So the analysts knew more what was going on operationally. But me, looking back, it's sort of insane. But so, you know, September turns to October. Eventually, we learned that we had people on the ground and that a war, you know, a military response was coming in October. And I can't recall the date exactly, but it was a weekend. And I got a phone call at home from a colleague of mine who was on the task force. Whenever something like this happens, a task force is set up to monitor things 24/7, you know. And there was a 9/11 task force. That's probably not what it was called, but there was a task force and task force. And my friend was on it, colleague was on it. She called me and she said, "I need you to come in. We have to write something for the president." So I said, "Okay." And I drove in and went up to the task force area and read what caused her to summon me. And I said, "You're right. We do need to write something for the president." So now my friend is a very extroverted, persuasive person, very smart. And I'm more introverted and quiet. So we sort of divided things up. Said, "Okay, I'll start to write the piece." She said, "I'll go up to the seventh floor and talk to it's called the President's Daily Briefing, the PDB." Said, "I'll go up and I'll talk to the PDB staff and I'll convince them to let us put our piece into the briefing for the next day." To back up a little, the President's Daily Brief is in most cases, a written briefing for the president. For President Bush, it was 6 days a week, and it's in a, you know, like a three-ring binder of written products that he receives each morning. And a CIA person is there to go over these articles with him verbally. So my friend, my colleague, goes up and starts to try to convince the staff to take someone else's piece out and put ours in. So I'm writing the thing. And by the way, we're both in our 20s. I was on the job less than 2 years. She was on the job just a couple of months more than that. Looking back, I was a baby. I didn't know anything. But we wrote this piece and it basically said, "Mr. President, if you want X to happen, you could consider doing Y." And we said that. We backed it up with our reasoning. And this was at night, so late at night. We got some adult supervision to come in. One of my managers came in to bless the piece. And he said, "Yeah, this is good. Send it." And meanwhile, my colleague was successful in kicking another person's article out of the PDB and getting ours put in. So long story short, our operation was successful. And the president read our piece the next day. And I'm thankful to say that in a very small way, the course of the war was changed.
That's extraordinary, Mike.
So it was something really neat to be able to do so early in one's career.
Yeah.
But all things being equal, if I could have, you know, gone back in time and had 9/11 not happen, I certainly would have done that. And
of course,
treated for a boring couple of first years of my career. But to be there and to be able to do something about it was probably the only thing that saved me from going, you know, off the deep end.
Maybe. Certainly.
Was something to be extremely proud of, no question. I suppose, thank you, Mike. I really appreciate you running through that. That's fascinating stuff. I suppose inevitably this brings us to the O word, you know, Osama bin Laden, obviously. The infamous raid, which, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was 2011?
Yes.
All right. I'd love for you, if you're able or willing, Mike, to talk a little bit about that. Can you talk about what that operation was like? How you were involved with it, or if you were?
Sure. I had nothing to do with that operation. I was overseas, living and working overseas, and it was compartmented within the agency. So even people sort of generally working on that target set, some people didn't know about it. It was really kept within a tight circle of people for operational security reasons. I was working in the former Soviet Union. Had been there. This was toward the end of my tour. I'd been there a couple of years and had done a lot of great, not great necessarily, cool things, interesting things, a lot of counterterrorism work, a lot of work against some of our regional adversaries. And I was sort of winding things down and that came in. So that, as I recall, that operation was announced pretty late in the evening in America. So for us, it was happening right as we were showing up for work. So found out as soon as I showed up for work that morning that bin Laden had been killed, that it was a CIA-backed military operation, CIA-inspired, however you want to call it. So, you know, a great day. We had the TV on. We watched President Obama give his speech. Very, very proud moment. And as, you know, time passed and it became more clear what our role, CIA's role, had been, just incredible pride, you know, to know that we had finally gotten him. It was truly, I believe, our finest hour.
Excellent. I would agree, Mike. I have one more question on your time with CIA, and then I want to move on to your book, Mike. You may have already answered it, but is there a particular accomplishment during your time with the CIA that you're especially proud of?
There's nothing I could say that I would say without getting into trouble for, unfortunately.
Fair enough.
I was wondering when that was going to happen.
Yeah. No, I could tell a lot of stories, but what's the famous line from Top Gun? I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you. No, the commitment to secrecy is lifelong. So I would have to get things blessed to be able to blessed by the CIA to be able to talk about anything. But you know, just in general,
yeah.
I can say I definitely saved lives in terms of counterterrorism. There's no doubt of that. And I can say that I, in my own very, very small way, changed history. And it was part of the response to 9/11. And for many years after, just not just, you know, wiping out Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and wiping out the Taliban, but the many secondary effects of that. I was dealing with that for years and years. I worked with so many amazing people. And I think the thing that I will look back on most is, yes, I will treasure the accomplishments and the fact that I, you know, was in the right place and time to be a part of these things, but especially the people, that's what I will treasure the most. I think just having relationships with these great Americans and, you know, serving side by side with them and some pretty bad conditions oftentimes. You know, the overseas work is not, you know, the best at times. I've been to a lot of really bad places. But when you go to a lot of bad places with people that you love and, you know, admire and trust and have great camaraderie with, and it's all worth it. So I look back on my almost 22 years with a lot of pride, and I'm grateful to have been given the chance to serve and to do all these things with so many great people. But I just can't talk too much about it. I wanted to add that in historical memory, 9/11 was a one-day event, but in reality, that was meant to be just the opening blow. And the story hasn't fully been told, and I'm not going to give anything away that I shouldn't. I think George Tenet alluded to it in his book. But in the days and weeks and months after 9/11, there was a nonstop torrent of intelligence, some of it probably credible, some of it probably not, that there were going to be follow-on attacks. And I'm not exaggerating when I say this. There were days when I wondered if I would be going home that night. It was that serious. Again, I hope the story can be told someday, but 9/11 was horrific, but it could have been a lot worse. And the reason it wasn't a lot worse is that because a lot of brave, smart, dedicated people stopped it. The homeland has been spared a spectacular attack for more than 20 years now. And that is not because the bad guys stopped trying. It's because they were stopped. And I want America to know that there are a lot of people working in the shadows to keep them safe. And they are very, very, very good at what they do. And they continue the fight. They set aside their families and they go off very often to some pretty bad places and do some things that they will wrestle with for the rest of their lives, but they do them anyway to keep America safe. So I just want you to know that.
Understood, Mike. No, thank you so much. I really do appreciate that. Want to shift gears a little bit here at the risk of giving our mutual audience a little bit of whiplash. I'd like to know what prompted you to write the book, Bombing Hitler's Hometown.
Sure, I appreciate that. In that the tour that I described when I was overseas for Bin Laden's killing, I sort of had an awakening in my mind that I had an uncle who was a combatant in World War II. And I had known about him my whole life, but had never really, you know, paused to find out more about him and what he did. I started a little bit in the late 2000s to get my father talking about him, but I wanted to know more. Now, my uncle was a bombardier in the 15th Air Force, which was the Air Force based in Italy in World War II. He survived more than 20 missions without a scratch, did some really great work. War ended, he came home, and he was up in South Dakota and learned on short notice that he had an opportunity to hitch a ride to Wisconsin. And from there, he would make his way to Illinois, where my family was. Well, the weather was bad, and plane crashed and killed everybody aboard. So my uncle passed at age, I want to say 23. So, of course, I never got to meet him, and I knew his death really affected my father because they were very close. And I can remember distinctly, you know, when I was young, my dad getting out a little lockbox, you know, once a year or so, and just sort of going through his possessions. And one of the things in there was a picture of my uncle. So I regret not asking my dad about it sooner, but eventually I did. And I'll try to make a long story short. My father passed away in 2008. And I felt sort of an obligation to try to figure out exactly what his brother did in the war. So came back from my foreign assignment, and I started to try to locate members of the crew that my uncle served on in the war. It was a B-24 bomber, so it had 10 crew members. And again, long story short, I was able to find the last surviving member of the crew, who was the navigator, Bill Johnson. He was my uncle's best friend. My uncle was First Lieutenant Ellsworth Croissant. They were best friends, and I'll never forget the day he called me. I wrote him a letter, and he called me, and to just hear his voice and say, I knew your uncle. He was my best friend. So it was incredible, and that was the start of a long journey toward sort of unlocking the mystery of my uncle, you know, who he was, what he was like, and what he did during the war. My aunts, my uncle's sisters, all have photographic memories. It's extraordinary. And they keep everything. So they gave me all of the newspaper clippings from the war and when my uncle passed away. And eventually I got a hold of his letters that he wrote home. So I was able to piece together most of the missions that he went on. So I just started to do research. Each mission, you know, what was the target? What was the date? Why did we go there? What was the mission like? And my attention pretty quickly fell upon April 25th, 1945 mission. The target was the rail yard in Linz, Austria. Now, Linz, Austria probably doesn't mean much to most people, but you know, some people would recognize it. That is the town that Adolf Hitler claimed to be his hometown. He spent about a decade of his first 19 years there, or close by. And a lot of things happened during that time while he was in Linz that sort of, you can see the early characteristics of the person we know as Adolf Hitler emerged there. So why did that mission in particular capture my imagination? Well, Vienna fell to the Soviets in mid-April. And Vienna had previously been the most heavily defended target for the 15th Air Force. So the Nazis were able, the Germans were able to pull many of the anti-aircraft guns that were guarding Vienna and place them in Linz. The rail yard in Linz was the last remaining major communications center for the shrinking German Reich in that part of Nazi Germany. So it was solid gold real estate, you know, to move troops and material back and forth between the various fronts. They needed that rail yard to stay open. And of course, the 15th Air Force had been attacking the yard on and off for more than a year without much impact. So this is April 25th. The war is about to end, but reconnaissance aircraft had detected a very large amount of stuff at these rail yards, you know, war materials and such. So the mission was sent out to you know, wipe this thing out and bring the war to a close. It was already doing that anyway, but just to kind of cross the T and dot the I, knock this place out. So all of the anti-aircraft guns that had been moved from Vienna here made it a devastating target. It was a hard target based on all of the men I interviewed to begin with. But on this particular day, with all these new cannons in place, it was just devastating. And this was a time before guided missiles. So anti-aircraft fire was essentially a cannon shot to the sky. There would be an explosion of metal at the same altitude as the bombers, and the Germans would hope that these metal fragments would pierce the bombers and either cause them to drop out of formation or shoot them down entirely. So I learned initially that, yes, this was a devastating mission in terms of men lost and bombers shot down by reading, you know, unit histories and newsletters, association newsletters. I started to get, you know, individual guys' perspectives on this, and I started to get names of people. I just dug deeper and deeper, sort of became obsessed. And to make a long story short, I contacted about 50, between 50 and 60 survivors of the mission and interviewed them. In addition to that, I tapped a lot of archives, and I lived not far from the National Archives, so I became a fixture there. A lot of the men that I talked to gave me diaries and letters that had never seen the light of day before. So suddenly, this whole epic story of the bomber raid was available to me, and I felt it was my duty to tell the story. It turns out it was the last mass bomber raid of the war in Europe. What do I mean by that? Well, I define a mass bomber raid as the entire Air Force going against a single target. In this case, it was the 15th Air Force going against the rail yards at Linz. Now, other bomb groups had other missions in the days that followed, both the England-based 8th Air Force and the 8th Air Force and the 15th Air Force, but neither of those sent their whole force after a single target. So I consider it the last mass bomber raid of the war. And it was devastating. The amount of anti-aircraft fire shot up at the men, the survivors described it as like a black wall, like a storm cloud, because when these cannon blasts went off, it was a puff of black smoke, and they describe it as just a solid black wall. And, you know, they couldn't take evasive action because the bombardiers were trying to aim the bombs properly, so they had to fly straight, and they're, you know, straight and level. They couldn't do anything but fly straight into this barrage, and that's what they did. 14 planes were shot down and 25 people were killed. So in my research, I found the names of many of the crews that were both shot down and not shot down. One crew parachuted from their B-17 and landed around Mauthausen, the concentration camp, which is near Linz. They were taken there and mistreated. Other crews that were shot down, you know, some were captured by the Germans, some by the Austrians, some by the Soviets. One airman, his aircraft made an emergency landing in Hungary, and because he was wounded, he was left behind while the Hungarians got the healthy crew members out of there. And he spent some time with the Hungarians, the resistance, to keep him out of German hands. Eventually, after giving him medical care, eventually they convinced him to turn himself over to the Soviets. And the Soviets, you know, he had unwisely, he had not kept his identification papers, and the Soviets believed, because he was blonde hair, blue eyed, that he was a German spy. And for days and days, they tortured him relentlessly and mistreated him. So his story is told for the first time. And in addition, it was just a tale of survival. You know, the roughly the first half of the book is about the mission, And then the back half is getting through it. The aftermath, a lot of the men had to be sent back to Italy via the Soviet Union. And they got in all kinds of, you know, tragic comic adventures with the Soviets, you know, drinking vodka and shooting randomly at things and just creating mischief. There's some humor, but overall, it's just a tale of, it's hard to believe that the men went through so much right at the very end of the war and never really told anyone. I mean, most of the guys, you know, their immediate families sort of knew in general what happened to them. But on the other hand, some men said, I have never told you this before. So it was very humbling to be given this amount of trust, you know, these life-changing experiences that these young guys, I mean, they were 18, 19, 20 years old, to be told what they went through. I was very much humbled and privileged to have told the story. Again, it's the working title is Bombing Hitler's Hometown. I'll be looking for a publisher later in the year for it. It's a love letter to the men, and I look forward to it finally after a decade, finally being out.
Yeah, excellent. Bombing Hitler's Hometown. Yeah, I'm sure a publisher will pick it up. No sweat. Well, Mike Croissant, this was a pleasure. It really was.
I tell my kids, you know, when an old person dies, it's like a library closing down. I mean, there's so much that's lost. And
it's well said.
You're not going to get anything out of them if you don't try, you know, and that's why I appreciate your show. And
thank you, man.
What you do is you ask the questions and get people to talk because, you know, history doesn't, especially now when we don't write things down anymore physically, you know, history can so easily vanish, you know, so
yeah,
good to force people to talk, you know.
I suppose I'll close this off with the most important question. How can people find out about you, sir?
Thank you. I have a website, mikecroissant.com, and you'll find there my social media contacts as well as an email address if you want to get in touch with me. And I welcome all feedback and anything you may want to know about me. All right. Thanks for all you do. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Likewise. Thanks, Mike.
All right, take care.
Bye. You too. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on eyewitness history, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.